Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the program. My name is Simon Barrett, and joining me this week are my regular panel of experts. From the City of Angels, we have well-known and well-respected attorney Peter Haven. Peter, welcome. Maybe it isn't Peter on the line. Okay, so who's on the 111 area code? No one. Okay. All right.
It's an NSA agent.
Yeah. My pet one. I'm bound and determined to find out who this is. Okay, who has call blocking and just called in?
NSA agent number two.
It's technology's grand, isn't it?
Okay. All right. Looks like we're going to get slammed here. Caller from the mysterious 111 area code, Hang Tough. From Youngstown, Ohio, we have activist, author, and barkeep, Sam Murphy. Sam, it is always good to talk to you.
Simon, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to solving at least one of the world's most pressing problems. What to do when the Browns are on a bye week.
All right. Okay. And from New Jersey, we have my good friend, Bill Conrad. Bill, good to have you on the program.
It's good to be here, Simon. Thank you for inviting me again. I really hope at the end of the day we did solve one problem, and as long as we keep our sights really low, we probably will be able to do that.
Gentlemen, can you hear me?
Right, and I do believe we now have well-known and well-respected L.A. attorney Peter Haven with us. Peter, hello.
Well, gentlemen, my apologies. I'm sorry. I was calling in on a landline, and I thought that I was going to have clear reception, and apparently I didn't, so I'm calling in from another line right now, and I apologize for the technical snafus. Forgive me.
These things happen. I can honestly say it's been a very interesting week. So we have lots of wonderful stuff to talk about. Unless any of you, have any objections, I'd like to start off with the micro-elections that were held last Tuesday. Obviously, it is too small a sample to make any sweeping generalizations, but center-of-the-road Republican Chris Christie barnstormed New Jersey, which is a predominantly blue state. Yet Republican Ken Cuccinelli lost the Virginia governor's race to his Democratic opponent, Terry McAuliffe. I see three factors in play, and I'm just saying this to annoy all of you. How much these three factors had in the outcome is completely unknown. Obamacare, the Tea Party, and the general public hating everything to do with Washington. Sam, you're pretty much the political guy. I'd love to hear your thoughts on
that? Well, I think you forgot to bring up the third election that happened on Tuesday, which to me means the most, is the election of de Blasio as the mayor of New York City.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was a huge, that's the first time in 20 years, over 20 years, Manhattan's going to have this is an insult to Democrats, to blame your political record, a Democratic mayor. From what this guy's going to do to New York City, it's going to harken back to the days of David Dinkins and of that nature, where the city is not going to be today what we see today, and based upon what he's going to do. And I don't think his election bodes well for the future of Manhattan, based upon his history, what he's about, what he promised, what he's going to do. Not that I didn't even know who the Republican candidate was. And after 20 years, obviously some people like to throw the bums out, and Bloomberg and Giuliani got their policies thrown out.
Who helped you
focus?
As far as the other ones go, Simon, all due respect, Cuccinelli, if that's how you pronounce his name, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering it, was down by 25 points over a month ago. And he didn't lose that bad. However, I'm no Cuccinelli fan, don't get me wrong. Said some stupid things. Once again, the Tea Party wings of the Republican Party elect people don't know when to cut their mouths about certain issues. However, I find it extremely interesting that the new governor of Virginia is nothing more than a moneymaker. All he does is he's a professional money raiser. So all he spent his whole life raising money from fat cats and big corporations to legally bribe politicians through campaign contributions. Now he's a governor. And I think that is the type of candidate you're going to see now. He's never held office. He's never done anything. But boy, can he raise money. And that's what they're, unfortunately, with Citizens United and things of that nature, those are the type of people both parties are going to get. It's all about the dough. And I think Christie winning was a foregone conclusion. And he sets up the 2016 mano-mano between Rand Paul and Chris Christie in the Republican primary, and I think that's going to be a great, great race to watch.
Bill, you live in New Jersey, so
yes, I do.
You know more about Chris Christie than I do. Living in Mississippi, I predominantly blue state, yet Christie won a second term. Were you surprised?
No, I was not. They didn't have a very strong candidate against him. And the reason Chris Christie got into office in the first place is that I think the mindset of a lot of New Jersey people is whoever's in office, let's just vote in somebody else. And he got in. And I think a lot of people were pleasantly surprised on a lot of the things that Chris Christie did, because he stood up and has a backbone against some of the things like they were expanding the tunnel system between New York City and New Jersey, and one of the bills that had passed was that New Jersey was responsible for all the project management change orders and overflows above the budget. And Chris Christie got a hold of that, and he stopped that from happening. So that's a really good thing. Again, that's how he got into office. And this time, Bono, it was not a very strong candidate. And I don't think that the Democrats put in somebody really strong to go against Christie because he has such a popular following. My only concern about Christie is Christie's view on everything is it's my way or the highway. There is nobody that has been on his staff that opposed him that he didn't say, well, it's my way or the highway, and leave. So that's a concern for me, because if he leads us in the wrong way, say, for instance, he becomes president and he decides that all the security issues with Homeland Security and anything about private information, if he believes very strongly in that, it's going to be very difficult to stop that whole momentum of losing all of our personal human rights. But again, he has done some good things, and my concern is that he's the kind of person that kind of browbeats people into submission, and you cannot go against him.
Peter, I'd love your thoughts. I know that generally you and I lean left. You must have looked at Tuesday and went, oh, Tea Party took it up the bum.
Well, I think that the Tea Party per se is alienating itself from America. That's my own personal opinion. I think they're clearly alienating liberals, and I think they're even alienating conservatives. And I think that they're doing their party an injustice by being so extreme, I think, because they're becoming out of touch. And maybe they know that. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they think that's their purpose. They just want to have a discussion point. I don't know. As far as Christie is concerned, I believe that the electoral process essentially functions correctly, that to the extent that mainstream America doesn't embrace these views, mainstream America is expressing that point of view. With respect to Christie, even though New Jersey is a blue state, I think once again the electoral process is demonstrating that it's still functioning and functioning well. Because I do agree with what Bill said, Bill said something different. I tend to think that people tend to prefer to keep the incumbent in position. And absent extraordinary circumstances, they leave the incumbent alone because it's familiar to them. And I think it's a credit to the people of New Jersey that even though it may arguably be a blue state, they don't just mindlessly adhere to party lines. If they see someone who's a leader who they think is reasonable and has reasonable positions, they will support him or her. And I generally think that that's the way elections function all over the United States. I think that generally speaking, the incumbent has an advantage, but generally speaking, people will be...
Yeah, that's the power of the incumbency.
Well, that's it's a power, but it's not an irrefutable power. People will uprise and throw off the incumbent if they feel the incumbent is really doing a bad job. See George Bush Sr.
But Christie did have the perfect storm, and the first guy he ran against was that Kurt Porzine. Am I right, Bill? Wasn't Porzine, he wasn't incumbent, too. He had already served a couple of years as a senator. He was a senator. Well, first he stole $1 billion from Goldman Sachs, got himself elected senator, lost that election, then he came back as governor. Is that correct, Bill?
No, he worked for the Department of Justice. He was...
No, that was Christie. I'm talking about Porzine.
Was
a Goldman Sachs boy. He was Goldman Sachs' guy. Then he bought a Senate seat, and then he became governor. I forget how that happened.
And just by accident, his girlfriend was the president of the labor union. It's just by accident, you know. There was nothing politically involved there.
There may be unusual circumstances that help people get into office, but getting into office is only half the battle. You have to earn the respect of the electorate to stay there. And I think Christie did that. I think he represents someone in the Republican Party who mainstream America views as reasonable and rational,
According to who, Peter? Who's he reasonable and rational to?
Well, I find him to be reasonable and rational. You could disagree with that, but I do. I mean, I think whatever position he has, he has a reason for it.
I think he's nothing more than a Republican neocon who would get us in the war, who will support the NSA continuing to whittle away at our civil liberties. And he's just a fat version of George Bush and those people. And he's the Karl Rove candidate. He's the John McCain candidate. He is the establishment, that moderate wing of the Republican Party that brought us John McCain, that brought us Mitt Romney, is now going to bring us Chris Christie in 2016. And Bill's right. He's not going to change anything. He is a neocon. People don't realize that. He's going to support the wars, going to be bought and sold by the military-industrial complex. The media loves him because him and Obama had a kumbaya moment after Hurricane Sandy a year ago. The guy, you know, that's who they want. That's who the left wants to see as a Republican candidate so they know they can beat him. He is so beatable nationwide, it's unbelievable. And that's why they do not want to see a Rand Paul candidate fee. Chris Matthews is already on the McLaughlin Group talking that that Rand Paul is the biggest threat to the what's going on because he talks across the party lines. He wants to dismantle NSA. He wants to have no more foreign aid is going to be cut immensely if Rand Paul gets elected president. And he wants to make the Fed transparent. Chris Christie is against all those things, and they know that, you know, that's why Christie's the establishment candidate, that's why he's getting establishment support, and the Democrats know they can beat the caca out of him in 2016.
Oh, okay, I like it. You know, it sounds reasonable, but in another way, it's not reasonable, right? The Tea Party are a bunch of wackos. I mean, at least with Christie, you know, there's some semblance of sensibility.
Let's say they are wackos. They control the primary in the Republican Party. Chris Christie will come in last place in Iowa, okay? Come in last place in New Hampshire and come in last place in South Carolina. Whether you like it or not. That's what's going to happen. He can't win those states. He can't because of what he stands for. And that's it. He can be the governor of New Jersey, probably be a cabinet member or something like that. Or maybe he was stupid to not appoint himself senator. I don't know why he didn't do that. That's just the way the nature of the beast is. Just like Barack Obama in 2008 ran to the left of Hillary Clinton and cleaned her clock in the primary. The Democratic Party is run by the far left. The Republican Party is run by the far right. The primaries. Now, if we have open primaries, that's a different story. Then you might see better quality candidates getting elected. But at least we forget what the process is about. Okay, because the far left, I mean, you look at who's running the Democratic Party right now. I mean, come on, you know, the Obama wing of the Democratic Party is a very left, is hardcore left wing. That's Elizabeth Warren, Pelosi, Harry Reid, those are not moderate thinking Democrats. You know, they're not. They are far left. But they don't get that, they don't get the same treatment that, the Tea Party's the wackos. What about the far left of this country? They're wackos too, but they don't. They get better press, I guess.
I quite agree with you, Peter. You're probably.
What one man sees as a conspiracy, I tend to see as the will of the people. I think the people want more moderate candidates. They don't want these kinds of extreme points of view because I think the people are more concerned about, you know, hardcore issues than they are about gay and lesbian marriage and abortion. But my second point is I don't think you said that there are these extremists in the Democratic Party and they have these extreme points of view. And I sat there for a minute and I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. I wonder what those extreme points of view are. I don't know what those extreme liberal points of view are. I do know the extreme points of view that the Tea Party has manifested because it so blatantly manifests them, and it makes them such an extreme outlier in what I view as the typical more mainstream American mindset. And I think that the whole nation...
You don't think redistribution of wealth and is an extreme viewpoint?
Well, you talk about
that's
that like
it's
an...
That's what the far left stands for, redistribution of wealth.
Well,
we're
you
seeing
talk
that.
About...
We're seeing, that,
you,
we're seeing that through Obamacare. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry. He said he was sorry, so we can't talk about that anymore. He apologized.
I don't know what you mean by redistribution of wealth. Are you telling me that the Obama administration is presiding over the transfer of wealth from the rich to the poor? Because it doesn't seem like that to me.
They support policies that they do.
We're getting
well,
into
whether they get it done or not. Look. Some people in Tea Party want to overturn abortion, Roe versus Wade. That doesn't mean it's going to happen, but that's what they stand for. So I do agree with you. They have extremist viewpoints. Obama and some of the people running Elizabeth Warren stands for redistribution of wealth. My God, tax the rich and give it to the poor via government programs.
Well,
that's
do you think most Americans would align themselves with redistribution of wealth or with anti-abortion? What do you think?
Redistribution of wealth, absolutely.
Well, look, I'm not convinced that there's some sort of movement afoot to redistribute the wealth in America, and I don't think any such movement.
I don't believe that any such movement
would be successful, certainly in no dramatic way. But I can tell you that all you're doing is proving my point, which is that mainstream America would align itself more with that type of philosophy than it would be the type of philosophy advocated by the Tea Party. So however you define it, I'm merely talking about the mindset of mainstream America.
Mainstream America that's a good question. Mainstream America? That's what I don't know anymore. To me, if you look at it, Romney's comment about 47% or whatever it was, it's 47% of the people in this country dependent upon government. So redistribution of wealth is government. They're not going to go to your bank account and take it and give it to Joe Blow. They're going to redistribute it through government policies and make more people dependent on big government. Such as Obamacare, as we fought too, that health care plan as it sits today is a redistribution of wealth, as I define it, makes more people dependent on government and government policy. And that's a redistribution of wealth. It's not a direct taking of money from point A, from person A, and giving it to person B, but it's more government control.
Sam, you're concerned about redistribution of wealth. You're concerned
government
about
government control.
That's one of the concerns in your mindset. That's what bothers you.
It bothers me that there's a couple, and the Republicans are involved in this too, my friend. Because they're not immune from using big government to control wealth.
All I can tell you is that I'm personally not concerned about redistribution of wealth, not because I just don't think that's happening. I just don't think that's happening.
Look at the growing gap to wealth, Peter. It's happening.
Now you're talking about something different. First you were talking about money flowing from the rich to the poor. Now you're talking about it flowing from the poor to the rich. I mean, which way is it?
No, not. What I'm trying to say is you think the vast middle class, it gets squeezed because the rich are getting taxed and whatnot, or the corporations, whatever it is, whatever they're using it for, to keep these government programs afloat. That government can only – the bigger government gets, the more control it has to have. Someone, besides printing money, they got to get it from somewhere to keep the monster, right?
So what you're concerned about is rich people being taxed.
I am concerned about the redistribution of wealth from the ultimate rich and middle class and small business, which I am. I am amazed at what I pay in taxes. Amazed. And that, what is that? What am I getting for my return on my investment? My roads suck. Okay, they don't pave the roads. They do less and less. Water bills go up. Everything that the government controls goes up. And I'm paying for people dependent on government. More and more people are dependent on food stamps. More and more people are dependent on government handouts. The government people who work for the government get incredible retirement funds, incredible perks, incredible pensions, and things of that nature. That, to me, is a redistribution of wealth. Taking from me, taking from others, and spreading it to and the return on the investment, my tax dollars and others, the diddly squat. I don't get that. And I'm paying for it.
Okay.
Along with millions and millions of other Americans. So that's a concern of mine. And the Democratic Party is up to their neck in dealing with this and promoting government policy.
Sam, I need to ask a question here, and I'm going to open it up to the entire panel. You know, the middle class in America is most definitely shrinking. You know, more people are poor, and some are much richer. I don't see that we're really moving forward at the moment. I disagree with the GOP version that, you know, it's all about Obamacare and and jobs, but I do think there is a huge problem. I mean, people are now living on part-time work. Many people have two jobs. That's hardly consistent with creating a middle class environment. You know, Sam, what is your view? What has gone wrong?
I just think there's been these bad policies by that have for years that have gone on. A great example, probably the greatest example I can give, is that in 2008 we had a financial meltdown because of greed. All these credit derivatives and all these programs that people warned for 10 years over easy credit and whatnot, and the housing market was going to come to a head. Both parties pushed for these loose regulations, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and all that sort of stuff to get make easy money. Your house became a giant credit card. I mean, I still can remember how many times people were calling me day in and day out, refinance. I mean, people were refinancing their homes 20 times a year, for crying out loud, to pull more money out, and the inflated bubble burst. Now, Obama came in 2008. Now, remember, with an opportunity to change that crazy casino gambling of other people's money. And then what happened? Two things. Too big to fail. So what happened because of recklessness by both political parties and banking systems, Main Street had to bail out Wall Street. Craziest thing. It never should have happened, but it did. And then they said, don't worry, to both parties. We'll take care of it. Everything's going to be fine. Not only that, we're going to go after those big, bad bankers. What they did was wrong. Oh, yeah, and what did they do? They then fined these big bad bankers for what they did. Never helped the people who were illegally stolen out of their home. Never. No one who got foreclosed on illegally was ever reimbursed for anything. What happened? They fined the banks. The feds gave each state a hunk of money so that state can then prop up its general fund and do whatever it has to do. And not one banker, not one politician went along with the ride or bureaucrat ever went to jail. Okay? What's wrong with that? The rich got richer. Wall Street, the politicians pocketed through campaign contributions got filled. No one was punished. And the middle class and the little people were screwed. And not only were the tax dollars used to bail out the bad guys that they threw to crooks, they were also left on the side of the street homeless. or back into apartments, you know, kicked out of their homes. Okay, to me, that sums up what's happened to me. It's a microorganism of what's wrong with Washington, Wall Street, and whatnot, and how Main Street kept it up the ass all the time. And that's still happening. And it's still happening. It happens. Whatever the issue is, type it in. You'll see Washington government and the people who bribe them, legally bribe them to campaign contributions, get what they want, and everyone else gets Tiffany Squad. And that's the problem. And that's why we have the inequities in right now that we do. The super wealthy and the middle class poor are the widening gap in ever since they've been keeping records. That's the problem.
Bill, I want to get your input on this. You spent many years, as indeed I did, in corporate America, and we got screwed. We got thrown on the trash heap. There wasn't any bailout for us, as I recall.
No, there wasn't. One of the interesting statistics that I read recently was that only 47% of Americans, for I think it was the month of September, have a full-time job. Something like 22% of those 47% are underemployed. That means that instead of making their $50,000 to $75,000 a year job, they're only making about the same as what they were making on unemployment. So this is a real big problem. Yahoo has claimed that about one out of four people have experienced unemployment in the last 4 years of their life. And, the statistics for unemployment we know is a problem because as soon as you go off being able to receive that unemployment check, your statistic of being unemployed goes off the federal government statistics. So really, unemployment is somewhere in the neighborhood of 18-20% in the United States. The rich are getting richer and the middle class is getting smaller and the poor are getting poorer. It's very, very hard to get back into a job. I've taken jobs that pay anywhere from 25% to 30% of what I used to make. Not that I was being overpaid, but it was a reasonable salary. Now it's very difficult for me to get a gainful employment. It's really tough.
All right, and I think it's fair to say that you're like the rest of us. You're in your 50s.
Yes, I'm in my mid-50s.
How does it feel to be old?
Oh, it was looking pretty good until they took away all my retirement benefits, and I'm struggling just to survive from day to day. I have bill collectors all over me, and I can't seem to get out of it. I am just so happy to have a full time job, but again, I'm working about 55 to 60 hours a week in order to make what I made on unemployment. So,
wow.
And still looking for a better job. And you share that with other people, and people that are gainfully employed don't believe me. They just think, well, I must be a loser. And it's like, no, just wait till it happens to you, because it's going to come to you. The statistics say it's going to come to you.
Hey, Bill?
I'm
sorry to hear about the bill collectors and whatnot. Have you ever considered just filing a Chapter 7 bankruptcy?
Thought about it, haven't looked deep enough, and I thought that I would spend some time with you.
Well, I can't.
You're California, but
well, no, no,
but
no,
just
but,
to
but,
look for
but,
some.
You know, as a general rule, when I see people hardworking people who are trying like heck to pay off their debts, and it's very clear to me they're not going to make enough money to do it. They're going to spend their whole life on a treadmill, on a treadmill. And I say to them, do what corporate America did. Do what the banks did. Do what the city of Detroit did. Do what sophisticated business people do all the time. Give yourself a fresh start. Start from scratch. Give yourself a fresh start. And, you know, I don't know how deep the problem is, but that's what bankruptcy is for. It's there. You know, my response to the bailout was, I think that at the same time they were bailing out all these people, I think at the same time they should have had some sort of blanket, unsecured debt forgiveness for all Americans at the same time, because I thought all Americans deserved a bailout as well. But one of the responses that people would say to that argument is, what do you mean? They can bail themselves out anytime they want. All they have to do is file a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Now, I'm not encouraging everyone to rush to the courthouse and file for bankruptcy, but I don't feel sorry for the banks when American consumers, have to seek that kind of protection. Because so many, you know, they make money off of us so many different ways that, you know, when I see people who are really underwater and they're trying to get back to the surface, and it's such a hard fight and it's such a long climb and you're trying so hard to do the right thing, I say, I can't help but think, you know, give yourself some help. Take advantage of it. You can only do it once every 7 years. And if you're at that point, I would encourage you to think about it, because you deserve a fresh start. Everybody else all of the other wealthy people who engineered the financial crisis gave themselves a fresh start, and they collected bonuses while they were doing it.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things was disappointing. I was down to 2 weeks on closing and consolidating all my loans, and I got dropped and they double checked my employment status, and so I didn't get the loan. But if I'd gotten the loan, everything would have gone away. I'd been paying less for my mortgage, and they would have rolled everything in there and reduced the length of my loan to where even making unemployment rates, and for all the contract jobs that I had done in the last few years, I would still be financially sound. You know, just by scrimping and everything, I could have made it go by. But now I can't pay for those old debts that had, you know, accumulated through through various points of unemployment over the last 4 years. So,
well,
anyway.
You said something interesting. You said a mortgage, so you sounds like you have a home, and obviously you want to try and protect your home too.
Yeah, my home's, I'm not behind on my home. It's the old credit card debt that's just not getting paid. Can't. It's, you know, otherwise I don't eat. And I make too much to get food stamps. So it's just all those silly kind of things that every time you get close to something, you make $44 too much a month, and so you're ineligible. You know, silly rules like that.
Okay.
Anyway.
The problem I have with all of this is that there wasn't any bailout for authors and book reviewers. Sam, you remember that. I mean,
yeah.
Why the hell did they bail out the banks and GM? Just let them fail.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. I think...
Did we lose Sam? Sam's brain heated up so much that he just got too upset.
No, I'm just... I like to listen, too. I have a big mouth, but I also don't want to shut up.
Yeah.
You know, so... I we brought this up, and, there really is, I've always said this, that there's enough money in this world to solve all the world's problems. I really believe that. But it doesn't get to where it's supposed to go. You talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but greed, that was a big thing. You're afraid that the greed thing is a very powerful thing that's really eating away at our society, and I agree with you. And nowhere was it more greedy than we just talked about, all four of us, within the bailout of 08. And we still got a student loan bubble that's about to burst. The stock market is all over again. I just can't believe we didn't learn our lesson, but right, the people running the show, you know, there's a reason why Obama and Ben Bernanke are spending $94 billion a month propping up governments and the stock market and bank institutions, because when they get out of Dodge City, they're going to be in great shape. The rest of us are not. Okay, because that's why what I think the most important piece of legislation being worked on right now is Rand Paul's hold on the woman who wants to succeed Bernanke. I think her last name is Yellen. That Obama expects to continue this easing, you know, QE, quantitative easing, is what they call it, and doublespeak, that means out of thin air, and that's what they're going to do. Rand Paul wants, okay, you want to put it in there, we want to audit the Fed. Now, I know a lot of people go, oh, my God, Peter, he's crazy. That's a Tea Party thing. And, you know, the Fed, you know, the Fed, us conspiracy people about the Fed. I don't have a problem with the central bank at all. I have a problem with how that central bank is spending its money and who is lobbying that central bank and why it's playing favorites with people and corporations and institutions. That I have a big problem with, because that's all, collectively all our money being used to be misused. It's being used to be misused, and that's not right, and it should be transparent in our government. Why didn't Bush or Obama, why don't they want to open up the books to let the feds, how were you guys cooking the books in 08? Why did AGI get bailed out? Why did you throw Lehman Brothers under the bus? How come Goldman Sachs was allowed to stay open? How come you didn't bail out the little guy? Why didn't you forget? We should have all these questions answered, because no one, the people in power, do not want to see how the American people, how they were lobbying and pushing arms to get money to go for them. And like you guys have brought up, the fact that AIG got bailed out, they all got bonuses. The fact that new GM was created so people at old GM could get screwed. The guys who, the people, the small businesses that were owed money, the stockholders who had bought that stock and it became worthless, they were screwed. And it will all come out in the two audits of the Fed. That, to me, is the most important piece of legislation that has to be used. And I go back to what you talked about earlier, Simon. And Peter, where I have a problem with Chris Christie as being a moderate, he's against that. He's against that because he's part of the problem. Chris Christie has come up through the ranks of the federal government, through the Justice Department, through the especially the one in New York, where when he was a U.S. District Attorney out of New York, everyone forgets this. Simon, you'll know this. What Federal Reserve Bank has the most power in the world? It's the most powerful. It's more powerful than the Fed. That's a bank within the Fed. Which one is it?
I'll let you rant on. I'm enjoying
it. It's the one in New York. The New York Fed is the most powerful institution in the world. Jimmy Geithner, who was Obama's secretary, was under that. Paulson comes from Goldman Sachs. Paulson, who was Butch's guy, came from Goldman Sachs. That place is bad news. That's the place where they screw the American people. Okay, where they just sit there and do all that, and they get all the. That's the ones who came up with too big to fail. They're the ones who spread the steel, and I don't mean EEL, I mean EAL steel, to certain people and whatnot. They're the ones, and that's what happens. And Chris Christie isn't going to bring change to that. That's why he'll be the candidate for the moderate version of to keep the thing going. And why they keep this thing going, guys, in my humble opinion, okay, when I say keep the status quo is what I'm talking about, whether Obama's president or Christie or Bush, the same institutions are getting richer and fatter and greedier at the expense of people like Bill who are having a hard time finding something, and other people. And there's so many other people dependent on government, they don't care. I mean, they get the welfare check, they get a free phone, they get free gas, free electric, free this, free that. Why should they go work? Why would you go out and work when someone's giving it to you for free? I mean, that's a terrible thing. And we have a society that, what does our society promote? It's success. You have to have a fancy car. You have to have a fancy house. You have to have fancy this, we have to have not fancy clothes. I mean, people in the ghettos kill each other over a pair of $150 sneakers, for crying out loud. I mean, it's terrible. And all that is from that G word, the beater that you used last week so eloquently, greed. And it's not enough that some of these people make $100 million a year. They're worth 80. No, God bless them for being wealthy. But how much wealthy do you have to get? And then, of course, we know, and what scares me, we go back to the NSA, that the Internet companies are in bed with the government. I think you all got an email from our esteemed friend, Manny Barling, that showed that AT&T gets paid $10 million a month by the CIA to share records with them. Well, if you look at your AT&T bill, guys, there's a tax on that already. And we're paying for the free Obama funds and things of other nature through our AT&T tax. Yet the CIA is giving them $10 million to give them more information. I mean, how much more fraud and waste? If you eliminate all the fraud and waste in our government, and I mean state government, federal government, local government, and whatnot, people be a lot better off. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen, because that's a powerful thing to have to overthrow.
Peter, you obviously have to respond.
Respond to what? There's like 8,000 things in there. I don't know which rabbit to chase. You know, it's just there's one thing that Sam keeps saying that I take one minor exception with, and he keeps talking about 2008 and Obama and what Obama did to address the mess. But he doesn't talk about the 8 years that preceded it and how the mess was created before Obama even got to office. And, you know, sometimes when you're handed a mess, you don't have freedom to deal with it any way you want. And I think that In the midst of everything you've said, I think that point was lost, and that's the only reason I raise it. You need to listen to me now, Sam. You just spoke for 5 minutes.
I'm telling you
that a financial bubble crisis, housing market, all of that. That had to have arisen during the 8 years prior during the Bush administration. You can't just say that Obama walked in and suddenly this was all his doing. Okay. Secondly, I can't address all these other points that you raise. I really can't because I don't know how best that situation could have been dealt with. I really don't. And I think that there is an impression out there that if you just let all these entities fail, then the problem is going to be even worse than before. And that's because of greed and corruption and the tentacles that go everywhere, in my opinion. And these people have a lock on things that allows them to survive these financial calamities and not only survive it, profit from it at the same time, because it's been my experience in life that people who care about money, that's all they care about is money. And they will always do whatever it takes to maximize their profit, minimize their loss, and make sure at the end of the day that they have dollars in their pockets. And that's a real problem, because those people, in my opinion, operate as a kind of stranglehold on everything. And they're everywhere. And they're insidious, and their tentacles are into everything. And I don't know what on earth can possibly be done about it.
Okay, everyone goes quiet.
It's a sad comment, but it's true. Go ahead.
You said, and I agree with you, that George Bush's previous 8 years is part of the problem. Do you want to know where the housing bubble started? Bill Clinton.
Okay.
Bill Clinton, who created the easy money with the help of Barney Frank, the help of the guy who's head of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, with Republican help too, and it's all details in two books, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and also Bailout by Neil Barofsky, who was the Inspector General of TARP, appointed by Bush and fired by Obama.
Well, if you believe that, Sam, if you believe that it started with Clinton, then why don't you hold the Bushes responsible for not addressing it properly?
Oh, I do. I do. But unfortunately,
okay.
Here's the problem, Peter. Here's the problem happened. They all looked the other way because both parties were profiting. You said it. It doesn't have to be politics. It doesn't have to be a money person in government. Excuse me. It doesn't have to be a capitalist per se to profit. Politicians profit from this stuff, too. Do you agree with me? They manipulate policies and whatnot because they want to profit. Maybe it's being reelected. Maybe it's a job in the private sector. Maybe it's campaign contributions. They want to profit, too, correct? Do you agree with me?
I assume the answer to that question is yes.
Okay, so I'm just trying to make sure on the same thing. So these policies.
Well, we are, but it always seems like there's a political motivation to your points, and it always seems to trace back to, your desire to blame certain leaders to the exclusion of others.
Well, they're the ones in power.
I'm not buying it. I'm not buying that all the world's ills can be laid at the feet of any one particular person.
So you would say that Hitler would not be responsible for the Holocaust?
Well, I'm talking about today. And the answer to your question is I don't think Hitler was exclusively responsible for the Holocaust. There were many people who followed him.
But someone came up with the idea and gave the order. It just didn't come out of thin air.
Well, it's not. If,
someone has to show the thing.
Sam, if I told you to go jump out a window right now that and it constituted an order, would you do it?
No, I would not do it.
Okay.
Look, you can't.
The waves of life don't function that things can be
laid at the feet of just one person. There are multiple people involved acting,
But somebody puts the plan.
So
in.
What?
Someone has to respect the plan. Someone
so
has
what?
To put the plan in action. Someone
okay.
has to come up with it.
Okay. All right. We did this last week. I mean, I'm really glad that, you know, that there's a huge difference in mileage between Youngstown, Ohio, and Los Angeles. Take your boxing gloves off. We don't need it. In fact, let's change.
Just so you know, Simon, when you say take your boxing gloves off, I think that has the exact opposite connotation that you intended. I mean, Sam, I think he just told us to fight more. Didn't you hear that?
Peter would never fight.
Sam and I have very healthy dialogue, but when you say, and the gloves come off, that conjures up images of hockey when we throw the gloves off and we fight even more. That's funny when you say that.
Okay. So I'm going to change subjects completely.
Cool.
All right. How about we talk about sports and the sports story of the week has to be the Miami Dolphins. Sam, any thoughts?
He went to get his boxing gloves. Sam, where'd you go? He does this. He puts down the phone, he walks away, and then he comes back.
No, I'm listening. I want Bill Conrad to go first. I want to take my breath.
Yeah, good. Go take it away, Bill.
Well, I don't have a whole lot of opinion about it. The question is Incognito telling the truth, you know? I mean, it seems like he's the one that's getting all the hassle, and he says now he feels like he's a victim.
I don't think he's saying that he feels like he's a victim. I think what he's saying is that this was part of a dialogue that was regularly engaged in, this type of language and vernacular. And for those who don't know, there's a story today that Incognito says that he received a similar text from Martin, in which Martin said, I'll kill your whole family or something. And Incognito's point was, I didn't take it seriously. He didn't really intend to kill my family. We were talking to each other like that, and that was part of the dialogue that arose, apparently not just between these two, but on the whole team. And so when people – Incognito's point, if I understand it correctly, is that when people heard this text message or voicemail or whatever it was, they interpreted it in isolation, and they didn't consider the extensive context in which it arose, which was, according to Incognito and I suspect others on the team, part of an ongoing dialogue or way of talking. And you know, people can certainly be shocked by that, but it seems to me that on an NFL football field on any given Sunday or Saturday or Friday night, for that matter, in high school, people are talking to each other like this all the time. They're calling each other names. They're talking about each other's mamas, and they're talking about killing each other. And I don't think any of them mean it literally. I think it's part of a dialogue or a vernacular that has arisen in the, quote-unquote, the game. And I think that was Incognito's point with respect to his story this morning.
So it's a lifestyle rather than a physical threat.
You know, when I heard about that, you know, I feel somewhat close to this story for a lot of reasons. First of all, I think I've said this before, I was a walk-on at Stanford. I was a walk-on football player at Stanford, and my position was offensive line. And that was 1982, and for those who don't know, what a walk-on means, you weren't recruited, you weren't a scholarship player, you literally walked on from the student body, and you were, quote-unquote, on the team. And I never heard anything as bad as what I'm hearing now, but I heard lots of colorful dialogue. And I have continued to play sports. I went from football, and I played what I would call semi-professional lacrosse. For about 20 years, I played in club teams. I played with guys who were professionals, amateurs. And I can tell you that on the lacrosse field, guys talk like this all the time. They just banter at each other all the time. And I've heard audio of NFL games, and I've heard candid sound bites. And these guys are constantly yapping at each other all the time. And it seems to me that some of that necessarily spills over into a way of talking and dealing with each other on a team. Secondly, you know, I went to the Fiesta Bowl a couple of years ago when Stanford was playing Oklahoma State, and I was in the airport the next morning in Arizona ready to fly back, and I was sitting in a gate ready to hop a flight back to Los Angeles, and I saw a nice couple walking up with a Stanford football helmet in their hands, and they sat down next to me. And I said, I used to wear one of those. Who's your son? And they said, Jonathan Martin. And I complimented them. I congratulated them on having a son who was about to be a future NFL draft pick, and we talked a little bit about it. And they were the nicest, kindest people, you know, you'd ever meet. And I'm also, as Sam knows, I'm a big Miami Dolphins fan. I've been a Miami Dolphins fan for a long, long time. And I kind of have been watching this situation unfold in Miami over time. And one of the things that I thought was interesting that no one is talking about is that, you know, Jonathan Martin was asked to take over a position that was previously held by a great player in Miami, and he's gone now. And Martin got put to this left side tackle spot, which is the so-called blind side protector. And he did an average job. They weren't really happy with his performance. And they ended up bringing in another guy, a 34-year-old late in his career player named Bryant McKinney. And that was on October 21st. And within days, McKinney had taken over Jonathan Martin's job at the left tackle spot, and they moved Martin back over to the right side, which is, you know, it's not like they were putting him on the bench, but it is something of a demotion. And it was on October 28th that Martin walked out of the facility. So, you know, it's hard to piece all these fragments together, but it just seems to me that something more is going on here than just words. And if what Incognito says is true, that he got a text message from Martin basically threatening violence upon his family, which isn't a threat. It's just dialogue. It's just chatter. Then, you know, it grays the situation somewhat. And I don't think we're really going to have any ability to talk sensibly about this issue until Martin's allegations come forward. And his allegations of, you know, a lawyer described something as a malicious physical assault. Well, to me, those are really cloudy phrases. I don't know what that means. A few years ago, a member of the New York Giants picked a guy up and dumped him into a whirlpool bath. You could call that a malicious physical assault. If guys snapped at some guy with towels in the locker room, that could be described as a malicious physical assault. So it's really unclear to me what's going on there, but there's some semblance, some sense I have that there's a bit of an overreaction going on, but I can't put my finger on anything, and we're not going to really know, maybe never, but we're not going to know for certain until we get a little bit more information out of Martin. And he's not talking right now. He's at home with his parents, and Incognito's out there basically talking to people and trying to explain what happened, and every other member of the Dolphins football team seems to be in Incognito's corner on this one, and everyone on the team seems to be shocked by these allegations and things that are coming out of Jonathan Martin. So it's very hard to piece the whole thing together right now.
Sam, you're a football fan, so I
well, no, now I know
that...
why Peter and I verbally spar. Walk on, middle linebacker.
Hey, buddy, you used to give me headaches back in the day. Thank
except,
you.
I was at a Division III school, Wittenberg University.
Well, you were probably a better player than I was. I sucked.
Actually, you know who's a better player than me? Both my boys. My son was the captain of his Catholic school team that won 4 state championship. My youngest son played on the team, too. My oldest boy went to the Citadel. He walked on. Now, you want to talk about anything? Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, it goes on. It happens. And people who are inside
I played in high school football and peewee football. You're right, Peter. Hazing, that's what I'm going to call it, hazing. To me, it's part of the NFL. It's probably worse than like anything else was years ago, tougher. It's a tough sport. I mean, look at these guys. They try to kill each other every Sunday or Saturday night, as you said, and Friday with high school football. I've seen it. I mean, my own kids 5-6 years ago, the trash-talking of Catholic schoolboys playing each other, right? And you know, they were playing, they used to call it, when the Cardinal Mooney Cardinals, when my sons played the Ursuline Irish, it was the Holy War. And, I mean, the trash-talking, not just between the players, the parents, the alumni, the cheerleaders, the band, everything. So that to me gets worse and worse as the stakes get higher and higher. High school playoffs, the big colleges like Ohio State, these got big money, big stuff, and it's got to get crazier and crazier and crazier. Part of it, I think, is my coach challenged me. I was undersized, was to get bigger and stronger. You know, they call me names and this and that, and to fire you up too. And, you know, it's a violent team, and you know you've got to be ready to go. I was a lot smaller than some of the other bigger players, but they weren't tough enough. They weren't crazy enough because I was, you know, my job was to break up the wedge on the kickoff team. You know, well, how crazy am I, right? Okay, so
that's the toughest job on the field.
That was about it. That's about the only time I ever got glory too, was on special teams. That's about as far as I went. But anyway. You know, and I understand all that hazing. And when this came out, I was like, wow. And then I did some research, found out he went to Stanford, came from a great family, all this. And I said, what? Something's not right here. This is NFL. And trash talking, you see it in basketball now. You see it everywhere. And it's all part of the culture of sports. And even in Little League sports, you see it. I mean, what's the worst sport in America? I think you'd be surprised. The worst things happen. It's Little League baseball. You ever see parents at a Little League baseball game?
Yeah.
I see parents had to be thrown out, police escorted out of a Little League baseball game. It's terrible.
That's right. That's right. To a certain extent. And let's just talk about the physically violent world of football. I mean, earlier this year, we had a guy literally lost the tip of his finger playing a football game. It just – I don't even know how it happened. It just crushed it right off. And we have all these guys getting concussions. We have all these problems. We have broken legs. We have guys who have gotten paralyzed. I mean, it's a brutally violent game. And because of that violence – people's filters are going to get turned off. They're just going to get shut down, and people are going to scream and yell and curse and rant and rave and do all kinds of stuff. And the fans and the followers and the networks and the reporters and the owners and the boosters, they all get caught up in it, and they do the exact same thing. And, you know, what's unfolding in Miami, in my opinion, is a focal point of a lot of different mental states all emerging. We've created this game. This is a reflection of all of us, you know, in America, in my opinion. And everybody wants to blame one person or the other, but I just don't think it ever really truly falls at the feet of one person. I think it's a collective enterprise. And, I think that at a certain level, we're all responsible for this. And we're just like we're all responsible for the concussions. And we're all responsible for everything else. Because we support it. We carry it. We prop it up. We want it. We want this stupid game.
Okay. So how can it be fixed? How can we have the fun and not the problems?
Well, that's like saying you want war, but you don't want bloodshed. And in my opinion, what happens is there's a constant state of ebb and flow. There's a constant state of evolution. You know, the NFL finally admitted recently, or didn't admit, but it's clear that it has to acknowledge that concussions are too dangerous to allow the behavior to continue. So they implemented a bunch of rule changes, and now people are being forced to tackle people differently. And it's still evolving. It's still evolving. And what's going to happen with respect to this exposure, if you will, is – I think it's going to be exposed that they were all talking to each other like this, and I don't think it's limited to the Dolphins. I think everybody in the league, to a certain degree or less, engages in this kind of verbal behavior. And it's going to be exposed, and people are going to feel bad because now the players are going to feel bad because now they know that there's a risk that what happens in the locker room, one guy may spill the beans on everybody and disclose it. And as a result, there's going to be some semblance of an effort to curtail this behavior. There may be new rules or regulations. The NFL may appoint new people to supervise this stuff. I don't know. But the things that feed it and cause it and create it, they're not going to go away. They're going to be there forever. It's just a question of how you control them. And there'll probably be some response to this, some attempt to control this stuff in the future, and it probably will have some limited success. But the forces that lead to this behavior are still there. In my opinion, they're not going to go anywhere.
Bill, you've been very quiet. I have no clue. You know, if you're a football fan.
Okay. it is what it is. it's a tough sport, and like you say, you know, you say that it's just in sports, but I mean, I see it in so many other industries where, you know, people talk trash to each other, and it's kind of a game, and you bait people, and it really holds no credibility, because after the shift, after the game is over, after whatever, people still go all out to the same pub and hang out with each other, even though to the untrained eye, you think that they're talking trash with each other. And, you know, this whole thing out of context, you know, I'm concerned that they're going to try to make some great, you know, some great training that everyone in America is going to, you know, like the assessment training, and now it'll be the talking trash and being disrespectful to people in your company or on your team, because you know, you need to be more sensitive to them. And you know, whether I agree with that language or not, I know it's a game, and I think we're just blowing something out of proportion that just needs to be addressed. You know, what needs to be addressed is the safety in football. What needs to be addressed is you know, whether or not you're being a good sport, and whether you're acting as a team together. And if you're not, then that's the kind of thing that you need to look at, not whether or not your language is all flowery and glossy, and that you know, you embrace and hug everyone on the team because you love them so much. You know, it's kind of silliness to me.
Sam, you and I talk occasionally, and you know, sometimes the conversation gets a little ripe. But you know, that's because we're friends. Is what is going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, but you know, one of the great things is, you know, like, yeah, Peter and I can go at it. Bill and I, me and you, have gone at it with Manny. We all know about the infamous John Perry, Peter Haven, thriller in Manila from a couple of weeks ago. But I think the general respect, and I know there's a general respect and give and take on both sides, and we're doing that. But what we're doing here is silence. It might be mind and the, you know, mind body. You're so mad, you want to. You know, I'm so mad at the system, and someone said something that ticks me off, like the NSA, and we all get mad at it. I don't want to beat up someone who I disagree with, though. I have no desire to do that. There's nothing to gain from it. But in the violent sport of football, and if you've played it, and you watch, except to watch, you don't have to play it. Just watch the thing. You know, it is, of course, it's going to take that into the locker room. There's no way these guys, excuse me, leave that field and become and go pick daisies and whatnot. Now, I'm sure there's a few exceptions to that. Some might think, some might do some other thing. These guys are violent nonstop, 24/7. Why do you think Michael Vick was in the dogfighting, for crying out loud? You know? I mean, think about it. I mean, it was violent. Violence, and all this money and all this fame and that happened so quickly, and they're treated differently than everybody else because they're very good at what they do at a young age. They it just goes up the ladder. It's part of the, but that culture is violence. You know, that's what it is. I mean, it's just no way when they leave the field. They may shake hands. They get paid big money to kill each other. Okay, you think about it. Rip that guy's head off and to do things. And they're gonna stop doing that when they go home. I don't think so. And then, of course, if there's a good team, like Peter was telling me about the psyche of the Dolphins, and they wanted to get this guy fired up and make him better, they thought he was going to do things, why not get a guy to jazz him a little and whatnot? Maybe that'll wake him up. Maybe that's what the coach happened to that coach who told Incognito, hey, fire him up, because that coach had experienced it, or he'd seen it happen. You know, that's the culture in that locker room, of all the locker rooms, and I agree with Peter on that. But then again, let's look at our culture as a country. We're a violent country. Murders, killings, shootings, stabbings, raping, it happens all the time. And the trash talking is incredible. I mean, I'm amazed that when customers come in nowadays of any race, color, and creed, and age, and what they say, the rude things that can come out of their mouths if the bartender doesn't serve them fast enough, isn't up to their speed or whatever. And it's amazing what they say. You never would have seen this, saw this 5 years ago. Now it's like
everybody. This isn't the first time we've seen this in the NFL. People have already forgotten. A few years ago in New Orleans, they had tape recordings of a defensive coach in a locker room telling people to target a knee and to go take out a knee. And he also said to them, if you kill the head, the body will die. You know, that was a coach. You know, and he's talking about attacking a team, and if you destroy someone's will – or you destroy some aspect of them, you know, they'll wither and die. They're talking in terms of war. They tell each other, kill him, blow him up, obliterate him, devastate him, destroy him. They talk like that. And they don't mean it usually they don't mean it literally. But when they do say, you know, go out and blow that guy up, and that's a common phrase in the NFL, blow him up. They mean hit him so hard that you just basically send him flying everywhere. These forces have been at work for quite a while, and that's the context in which all this arises. And then when you have people who are shocked to hear that this kind of language is being used, I think that they're living in a little bit of a bubble when they don't realize that this is a common. This is a common way of speaking to each other. Even if in this particular instance it was extreme, they talk profanity and your mama, and I think they talk race a lot too. The other thing that concerns me about this is, I fear or sense that there's a lot of lawyering going on in the Jonathan Martin camp right now. They've hired a lawyer. The parents are lawyers. The bottom line is this guy Martin walked out on a football team. He was getting paid $600,000 a year, and he left. And he didn't go talk to a coach and leave. He didn't go talk to somebody and leave. He just stormed out. And I'm a little concerned that now the truth may get diluted in an effort to kind of rehabilitate the situation. From his point of view, I'm not certain of that, but it concerns me. And I suspect that when this report comes out next week, there's a Martin Camp report that's going to be coming out. I expect it will be very scathing, and I suspect it will be influenced by the hand of a lawyer in some way. And I just don't know what it's going to say. I do know that Richie Incognito is sitting out here talking and discussing this, and all of his teammates supposedly support him. And the other person in this isn't talking, isn't saying anything, is at home by all accounts with his mother and father, and has a lawyer. And there's just so much more going on here. It'll be interesting to see how it all unfolds.
Give me a guess, Peter.
Well, here are my predictions. I think one guy who is going. I think there's a witch hunt now. You know, when there's a scandal of this nature, people demand that somebody's head end up on the chopping block. They're just not comfortable with all of this hullabaloo and nobody paying the price. So I think the most likely candidate to have his head chopped off or lose his job over this is the Dolphins general manager. And I think that's Jeff Ireland, because there is a report, and I emphasize a report, that Martin's agent contacted Ireland and discussed with Ireland problems that Martin was having before Martin left the team. And according to this report, which again is just a report, the general manager didn't have a very productive response. He basically suggested that Martin needed to toughen up, that Martin needed to be a tougher guy, and that if he thought that Incognito was bullying him, he should stand up to Incognito and, I think the quote is, punch him in the face. Now, I think what's going on in Miami is that there was a perception that they wanted to get Martin tougher for whatever reason. And this is not uncommon. You know, I saw a Hard Knocks episode a few years ago where Rex Ryan was captured on tape as walking up to a guy on the team when he was for the New York Jets. And he said to the guy, I want you to get in a fight with that guy. Get in a fight with him. I want to toughen him up. And, you know, it's a common tactic in the NFL to try to get guys to be tougher. So there's a perception, I think, in Miami that they wanted Martin to be tougher and more nasty. And I think Incognito took that task to heart, and he may have pushed too hard. But when you call management, when management is put on notice from the employee or the player that there is a problem, management is supposed to handle it differently. So I think Ireland will lose his job because of this. I think eventually there'll be some suspensions. Incognito's on a four-game suspension now. They may try to extend the suspension. That will go up on appeal. I think that next year Incognito and Martin will both be back in the NFL. I don't think they're going to be on the same team. I think they're going to be on different teams. And I think their careers will play out for whatever it's worth, 1, 2, or 3 years. I think whatever problems Martin had making it as a player in the NFL, he's going to have similar problems wherever else he goes. And Incognito's reputation will follow him, but they'll play, and I think they'll last maybe another year or two. There may be some civil lawsuits out of this. I'm not sure. And I think eventually the Dolphins head coach will lose his job, too, because of just institutional lack of control and cleaning house. But I think that the primary scapegoat is going to end up being the general manager.
A quick question, because I'm sure that Sam wants to chime in. I thought Incognito was Incognito indefinitely, but you're saying just 4 games.
Well, they can suspend him. I believe they can suspend him for 4 games for conduct detrimental to the team. After that, I believe that there's a collective bargaining agreement in place, and the collective bargaining agreement requires them to either reinstate him or cut him. And I think what they're going to do is they're going to cut Incognito after the 4-game suspension. I'm not an expert on the collective bargaining agreement, but they are going to cut Incognito after the 4-game suspension. And after that, it's a question of whether or not the NFL is going to suspend him. And the NFL may very well say the NFL may try to lower the boom on him, although it's unclear to me, given the kind of conduct that other players have engaged in, it's unclear to me how much they're going to be able to suspend him. We had some guys in New Orleans who were supposedly paid money by the team to injure people, and some of those guys got a year-long suspension, and it was tremendously convoluted, and at the end of the day, the NFL had to back off some of those suspensions. Depending upon the allegations, I can see the NFL trying to suspend Incognito for a year, but I also see Incognito taking that up on appeal, and I think that during the appeal, that suspension may get reduced to a half season or something. But I do think, based on the prior precedents for this, I think that he'll be eligible to play for another team at some point next season, and it's just a question of who wants to hire him. And I think somebody out there will, because he's a Pro Bowl caliber player, and he's a nasty guy, but his teammates love him, or not all of them, many of them do. And I suspect that, you know, with injuries and people needing help, there'll be somebody in there looking to hire him. Martin, I think, may actually have a tougher time finding a home, because now there's a perception that he's too soft, he can't hack it, he's a snitch, he can't be trusted. So it's unclear to me where he's going to land, and he may choose to just pursue lawsuits and try to make his money that way. I just don't know. But the short answer to your question is, my understanding is they can suspend him for 4 games, then they either have to reinstate him or cut him, and the NFL has to make a decision of whether or not they're going to impose a greater suspension. And if they do, that is subject to appeal by the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. I do believe that today is week 10. So if he's suspended for four games, that would give him two games to play in.
Well, it actually, the Dolphins have played eight games to date. They had a bye week and, you know, what have you. I don't know how these things are perfectly measured, but they've only played eight games. It's a 16-game season, I think. So that takes him out to 12 games, and then there's four games left, but I think they're going to cut him. I don't think he's going to play for the Dolphins, I think, but you never know how this whole thing will turn out. They may decide to keep him after all this gets unraveled. I don't know. The players seem to want him back. So, but around, you know, what is basically the 13th week of the season, which will be the 12th game for the Dolphins, after that, I think he'll be eligible to return as far as Miami is concerned, but it's not clear what the NFL will let him do. They may impose a further suspension.
Sam, any thoughts?
I think what's going to happen is, like, Bruce Peter, someone in management, something's wrong with the Martin side. It just doesn't jive with me based upon what I know about football. But then again, maybe I'm missing something. That will all come out. The NFL has to save face. After all, the NFL stands for no fun league. They got to punish incognito for me because it's the right thing to do. They will get rid of him. However, that guy can play football. He will be back in an NFL camp somewhere next year playing football next fall. He's good. And everything will be forgiven and all that. Martin's in big trouble. I don't think he'll ever be on an NFL team again based upon the culture that they have. So they'll have the investigation. It will be, you know, what will happen will happen. And someone from the Dolphins' head is going to roll. That'll be a sacrificial lamb.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock, and it's winding down fast. So I want to go around the table one time. Peter, your last thoughts for us today?
Well, another lively discussion. And Sam, I love you like a brother. Love to spar with you verbally and otherwise. And I thank everyone else. And, you know, a few more problems discussed today. Thousands more to address later. And I look forward to the next time.
that was short and sweet. Bill, your parting thoughts were
again today. It was great. I really liked the conversation. It was kind of nice to sit back and watch the ping pong game go back and forth. And I think we accomplished something. I feel good about us. And, you know, it wasn't like last week where I felt a little hopeless, but this was good. This is good.
Sam, your parting comment.
I enjoyed it as always. It's fun. It fires me up. Peter, Peter and I know we both agree on more things than we disagree on.
Correct.
But when we disagree, that's what it's about. But I kind of like today's show. It was kind of free for all. I like the fact we're talking about, you know, our football hazing incident. That's really kind of a indication of our culture. That was very interesting. And we didn't talk about Obamacare, Benghazi, so life is good.
Right. There's nothing wrong with Obamacare as long as you're not wrapped up in it. Uh-oh.
Obamacare's fine as long as we have Benghazi to temper it with.
Look, he said he was sorry, but that's all you need to know.
might have a big update next week on Benghazi. There's a lot of pissed off people. Okay. Until next week, this is Simon Barrett. wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. I want to thank Peter Haven and all of the rest of my guests for taking part. We'll be back again next week. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Till then, goodbye.